Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my co-host and good friend, Michael Walker. Walker, you don't look like yourself today.
Well, I'm not feeling quite like myself, you know, Mark. I woke up this morning and something was off.
Oh, I'm getting a memo from the HR Gibbons, and it says, all swag and no Jimbo makes Jimbo a Jimbo Jimbo. Do you know what that means?
Now, you know, I'm not good at translating the Gibbons speak, especially because sometimes they don't speak to me after the incident.
So with us is Swag's favorite Canadian guest host, the man known only as Jimbo. Look, I don't want to nag.
I mean, that's
too
fair.
Aggressively, Efka and Mark, but you know they're not here, so
yes,
whatever.
Exactly, that's true.
So Jimbo has very kindly decided to step in because Walker is sick unto death.
Yeah, and in fact, earlier this morning, admitted to not feeling great, which in Walker speak is I might be dying.
That is legit concerning. I mean, it's partially a joke, but that is legitimately concerning.
Yeah.
He was too sick to play games yesterday, and when I said, maybe we should consider either skipping a week or having Jimbo sub, he's like, why? I was like, Walker, if you're too sick to play a game on Sunday, I don't think you should record a podcast on Monday. But Walker is like, well, of course I'm too sick to do something I want to do, but work is something I have to do all the time. Anyway. Yeah.
This is Walker's dedication to the cause, listeners. It is. He would stagger in here, leaking black tar from his eyes and ears, and sit down to record rather than miss a day.
And speaking selfishly, he would probably rather infect me with whatever he's got.
It's just good for your immune system, Mark. Yeah. It'll toughen you right up.
So we're going to talk about board games this week, Jimbo. We are going to give the listeners what they crave, that sweet, hot content right into their faces. We're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus, where we talked about what Walker and I reviewed last year. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And our topic this week is a topic in your honor, and that is about frustrating randomness.
I've never experienced frustration with randomness, Mark. That's just...
Look, as a man who himself has pitched minor fits at a game table when things haven't been going his way, I am deeply sympathetic. This is a safe space. No one's listening. We can let out our deepest, darkest secrets. So our Eurus this week is Revive. This is the medium-heavy Euro by Helga Meissner, Eilif Svensson, Anna Wermlund, and Christian Amundsen Osby, published by Aporta. It is probably my favorite game of its ilk of the past, I'd say, 5 years, which is to say the medium-heavy Euro. I do love how the card play works. I love how it interacts with the map play. I love how you're getting toys, but you're not drowning in weird side conditions and reference works. Not that we're going to be talking about any games of that type later or
Cough.
Anything. Yeah, yeah. And there's one thing, though, that I completely forgot. We talked a few weeks ago about Revive because we played Revive again. I keep trying to bring it to the table. I want to keep it in rotation. And you commented that you find it difficult to keep it in rotation for a very understandable reason.
Yes, for whatever reason, the name Revive refuses to adhere to my mind. Frequently when Walker brings it up, I have to ask, which one is Revive? Or when I'm trying to articulate, oh, we should play that, you know, the interesting game with the hexes and the deep squid and the crystal skulls. It's usually the crystal skulls that bring it home.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, the name Revive just slides right off my brain.
This is often a failing that Euros have, but not necessarily. Like Great Western Trail, no one has any difficulty remembering what that one is.
Very true.
It's the one with the Great Western Trail, even though the trail doesn't make any sense, whether it's in New Zealand, whether it's in Europe, or whether it's in the United States. But nonetheless, good branding. They needed better branding.
I agree. They needed better branding.
They could have just leaned into the crystal skulls. I don't know.
Yeah, quest for the crystal. Maybe then you.
A little tainted.
Yeah, yeah. You maybe risk some lawsuit attention from one of the most litigious companies on earth. And we're not talking about Nintendo this time.
Absolutely. I love Revive. It's great. I had completely forgotten, though, one thing I didn't mention a couple weeks ago when we played it. The setup is a little more onerous than I remember.
Yeah, the setup for Revive always surprises me because there is so one of the things that Revive, one of the many things Revive has going for it is there's a lot going on, but it's in a way that gives you options. It is easy for games like that to be a lot going on in the way that you are totally overwhelmed and have no idea what you should be doing next. Revive, I find, gives you. It does, you know, it does present you your options with a shotgun blast to the face, but they are still clear options like, okay, well, I want to do this thing, and oh, that means that I need to do this and this and that and this. But as a consequence, it means that the setup is quite a bear.
Yeah, the aforementioned toys, there's a lot of different stacks and a lot of different things. Not a whole lot of sorting to be done. It's not like, well, these are the level 3 techs, and you shuffle them below the level 2 techs. But there's a lot of different piles of things to manage. And I do appreciate, though, at least there's a lot of different ways to get resources and a lot of things going on. But fundamentally, you're putting out buildings, you're flipping tiles, and you're putting out people. So there's it funnels it to a reasonable degree of focus where it matters. And that's one of the reasons why I prefer it over a lot of other comparable Euros.
Yeah, no, agreed. And again, a little bit of foreshadowing, maybe. Actions in Revive feel consequential.
Yes.
Even if you're just spending a turn, playing a card or two to get some needed resources, those resources then open up much more consequential actions in the future. Very rarely, not, I wouldn't say never, but very rarely in Revive do you have a, well, that felt like a wasted turn.
Well put. So that was Revive. One of my favorite Euros of the past few years. Very happy to keep it in rotation. Let us move on to the games we played last week. We've had enough foreshadowing. We've had enough. This would be, I guess, dramatic irony on the part of us, the hosts. Let's talk about Civolution.
Yes, let's.
Civolution is done by Stefan Feld, published this year by Deep Print Games. It is, as you might imagine, a Civ game. And it is also, as you might imagine, a Stefan Feld game. I don't know what your experience with Stefan Feld is, Jimbo.
I'm actually extremely terrible at linking designers and developers to their works.
Sure.
The same when it comes to video games. I'm not good at linking individual designers. So I'm not 100% sure what other things Stefan Feld has done.
He's perhaps best known for Castles of Burgundy.
Okay. I enjoyed Castles of Burgundy, and I did not enjoy Civolution. My initial response was a bit overblown, I think, but I bounced off Civolution pretty hard. Quite contrary to what we were just talking about with Revive, I found that actions in Civolution frequently felt either inconsequential or impossible to achieve. They have a really interesting...
A console
with cardboard tiles in a lovely double-layered board that allow you to sock dice away to do the actions. The problem is that since you're randomly rolling dice, frequently those actions are out of reach. And now, again, as just about everyone will jump out of the weeds and say, wait, there's mitigation to the randomness, Jimbo. It's not true randomness. Okay, there is. There is focus, which allows you to take one of your wooden pylons and treat it as a die of any face. And then there is ideas, which allow you to adjust a die up or down by one value. Sixes wrap around to ones. You may spend more than one idea. Focus is extremely thin on the ground. It's very difficult to get focus. The most common way is to take the sleep action, which I think we can all agree when overwhelmed, just have a little sleep.
Yeah, you can get it, but it doesn't feel, as you say, satisfying. It takes two dice, and
yes,
with those two dice, you could be playing a card or doing something else. So just wait. It feels like you're skipping a turn so you can actually do the turn you want to do.
Precisely. Now, despite that, despite my initial bouncing off, despite my initial hostility, I do want to go back to it because I, for example, one of my frustrations was I got, I think, 4 cards into play total, which was very frustrating because some of the most interesting aspects of Civolution to me is the building up your console. But then I looked over at your console and you had 8 to 10 cards into play. So I think that was a me thing. That was a my not grasping what I needed to do to get those cards into play. For one thing, ironically, for the card system, you can play the cards in different levels on your console from 1 to 5. and you only need to pay the resource cost for the level you're putting it in. So if, for example, the card says you need 2 wood, and then you need a brain, and then you need a sulfur. If you're putting it at level 1, you only need the 2 wood. But for despite the fact that that was clearly explained, my brain went, these are the resources. I must pay these resources. And you do get victory points for paying those resources, even if you're putting it at a lower level. But I definitely think that probably held me back a bit with that need to complete each of them for the most victory points.
So the skill ceiling seems pretty high. But it's a skill that I don't tend to appreciate too much in strategy games, which is to say it's a system mastery thing. I think it's just about getting familiar with the system and making sure that you can take those turns as efficiently as possible. And so you're just learning how to civolution better,
yeah,
as opposed to outplaying your opponents or outfoxing the game system. Because there was a considerable margin between the scores at the table, and there were various thresholds that would have resulted in points bonanza that none of us got close to.
Yeah.
So we talked about the console, you can get to levels 4 and 5. Every card you slot into level 4 and 5 is worth a lot of points, but only if you've activated level 4 and 5 in your console. None of us activated any of the additional levels. There are ways to do it a small number of ways. No core ways. I hate it when that happens. So it's a significant... This never became an issue, so it was entirely theoretical. But I strongly dislike it when a large amount of points is gatekept behind something that is not a core action or a core feature. It's okay, well, how, in other words, as a rules explainer, and maybe this is driving part of my dislike, I don't think all of it though, if someone asks, okay, how do I unlock level 4 and 5 in my console? It's like, well, there are three entirely disconnected ways it could happen. Put out all 4 of your settlements, or this track advancement over here, because of course there are tracks. Of course. Anyway, I could go on about that element.
Well, and it's particularly interesting, that aspect of it for me, because when I first looked, I was like, oh, there's lots of ways to unlock my level 4 or 5. No problem. Once the game actually started, that was when my brain caught up and went, oh, I have to go way out of my way to do these things. This is,
Yeah.
And unfortunately, as a result of spending a lot of the game feeling like I had a chain around my ankles, did not get those things unlocked. I want to unleash some particular rancor for the exploring mechanic.
Mm.
What could have been a really neat mechanic ends up being so arbitrary and desperately unsatisfying. So there are these hexes on the map that will be adjacent to face-down locations, and you can explore. And ideally, exploring 2 or more locations at once will give you a chunk of points. Not necessarily a big chunk, but a chunk of points. And will reveal some interesting locations. The points difference is massive. So
yeah,
on the first turn, Walker explored and got, I think, 5 to 8 points. I do not recall exactly how much.
It was 12?
It was 12.
It was double digits, yeah.
It's a lot of points. And then in future turns, Mark was using a special ability to explore places that he wasn't even next to and got on average, I think, 2.
Yeah.
Maybe 3 points. And a side effect then is that there are bad locations you can find. And the first explorer and then the second explorer flipped up 3 of them. So one location was a volcanic glacier that was just heck on earth.
Yes.
And one location was a volcanic glacier prowled by grim wolves, which meant effectively that location just didn't exist for the purposes of the game.
It was a bad place.
It was a very bad place.
Nobody goes there. Yeah, the grim wolves were a strangely thematic touchstone in an otherwise very abstract, unsatisfying... Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to know more about these Grimwolves.
I would also like to know more about these Grimwolves and the fact that they saunter into town and demand tribute.
Yeah,
do they have leather jackets and greased pompadours?
I don't think so. Although they might be showing up in season 2 of The Penguin. It's difficult to tell.
Yeah, you never really know.
Yeah, so to say that a EuroCiv game is pretty themeless is par for the course. And the kind of... the dizzying array of actions... they can all be upgraded into level 3. That's why the console is double layer, because to upgrade them to level 2, you flip them over, then you remove them, you get level 3. I didn't find the upgrades particularly fun. Like, for example, the Explorer upgrade from level 2 to level 3 is you get 2 more points when you do the action. That's just a flat bonus on top of it. Fine, whatever. I mean, it's okay. Similarly, the action upgrades are relatively easy to come by. So I was hoping that was going to be more interesting, like that I would get a sense of customization, because one of the appeals of Civ games is you get to play with toys.
Absolutely.
I didn't really feel like I was playing much with toys.
No, part of the problem is it felt like there was a padlock on the toy box. And then every so often, you could, like, squeak the lid open a bit and maybe just... pull a toy out with your fingertips.
Yeah.
And have it for a bit. And, like, I take no pleasure in this. Walker was very interested in this game. And anytime a game like this comes out, I want to like it. And it just, Civolution did not hit for me in a lot of different ways.
I was less surprised, frankly, because Steffenfeld is a very hit or miss designer for me. I'm not a huge fan of Castles of Burgundy, but I think it's okay. I think that Luna was one of his better designs. Every once in a while he does something that strikes me as interesting. I actually like a lot of his, oh my goodness, I can't believe him, but I like a lot of his early work. I like Notre Dame, I like In the Year of the Dragon. But since then, he's just been churning out point salad games after point salad games. And point salad games, broadly speaking, when they are rules dense, end up feeling like much ado about nothing. I'm just grappling with the system to eke out a couple more numbers here and there. And if you can do it with personality, that's great. But broadly speaking, personality is not, I think, Steffenfeld's strong suit when it comes to game design. And so consequently, it didn't have any of the historical appeal or toy factor appeal that a lot of other Civ games do. And I didn't find the core mechanical elements, because I'm not blind to the joys of system mastery.
Oh, absolutely.
I enjoy, I'm a Magic Realm fan. Any Magic Realm fan must acknowledge that they have some appeal for system mastery. But ultimately, it's this dense network of actions. And it's not that you roll dice and activate. You need two dice to activate a specific space. Why are you building this potentially strategic game and then shackling you to these very narrow tactical horizons? Like, oh, I want to play a green card. I'd really be in a good position to get a green card. Oh, do you have a 6 and a 5? A 6 and a 5. Well, better luck next time, or waste a turn with sleep.
Yeah, I found it made it difficult. Again, not impossible, but difficult to plan a route forward. It was almost like you just had to, roll your dice, look at them, and be like, well, I guess this is just what I'm doing this turn.
Now,
and again, in the game's defense, there is a planning action that allows you to have a bunch of sort of pseudo dice set to one value. But that's the kicker, is the one value. Like, okay, I'm going to use a planning action. I'm going to turn these two dice, let's say I've upgraded it, into 3 5s. Well, now I'm only using those for 5s. So again, maybe grappling with it. And of course, everything we're saying, if you take a great deal of pleasure in grappling with systems and mastering them, this might absolutely be for you. This might be a game you adore. But for me, I found it just, I just felt like I was constantly being held back. Like I would, jump out the back door and leap off the porch only to be clotheslined by the leash.
Yeah, this is definitely a Steffenfeld game for Steffenfeld stands. And just as one minor concluding note on that same topic, I think my first grave realization that something was weird was when we were looking at the scoring conditions. And there's some cleverness to be had in the scoring conditions, frankly. It's a little bit of an interesting evolution on the fundamental idea that Terra Mystica introduced, which is, well, this round you want to do this, but next round you want to do the other thing. And then there's endgame scoring, which will give you fewer points for all the things you didn't score during the game. And I thought that was kind of cool. But a lot of it is track-based. And going up the tracks, a lot of your progress up the tracks is going to be by playing the right kinds of cards. And getting the right kinds of cards is hard when your throughput is so narrow.
Yep.
So, for example, I got a wash of points because I was able to play Jewelry, which sent me 3 slots up the Prestige track. And the Prestige track was very remunerative for me over the course of the endgame scoring. And I just lucked into that card. It was just, there are a bunch of cards from that deck that might get you up the green track. And I just happened to stumble on a pretty good one. So, yay me, I guess. It's this awkward juxtaposition of system mastery and tactical reaction to what you're going to draw or roll that I find very strange.
The other thing, I'm not sure myself how I feel about it. A Sidewinder once raised after a stream some frustration about if a game's end scores can be so disparate that tends to turn them off. And the end game scores for Civolution were exceptionally disparate, like 100 points different.
To me, that speaks to that there's a high horizon for mastering the system, which doesn't surprise me because there are people who like to do that. If you really enjoy playing the same game over and over specifically so as to come to grips with the mechanisms, then yeah, I think Civolution's got a lot for you. But at the same time, you have to also want to be able to play reactively to what the dice and the cards are giving you. So again, that doesn't sit well for me, but who's to say? Yeah, I'd be willing to play it again as well, because there's a lot of stuff in there. I just don't think it coheres very well, and it's definitely not a vibe that speaks to my preferences.
Yeah. No, same thing. I would like to go back to it to give it another shot. I'm trying very hard not to just dismiss games out of hand the first time I play them. But first impressions with Civolution left me kind of cold.
That's Civolution by Stefan Feld, published by Deep Print Games this year.
We also got to play Race for the Galaxy. Walker, this was the perhaps one of the first times I've ever seen Walker have to leave the table. He was so sick.
I think it's Race for the Galaxy that did him in.
If you're racing when you're sick, then
his immune system looked at Race for the Galaxy and said, "It's either this or illness." All right, boys.
Tarps off, boys.
Yep.
Race for the Galaxy is a action-based card game. I'm not good with categorizations, where you choose a card from your hand that corresponds to actions, and then you build up your tableau using cards. So you might draw cards, for example, with a scouting action, or you might draw, sorry, exploring action, or you might draw cards by selling goods from your existing cards with a selling action, that you will discard cards to pay for develop actions. And I'm not describing it well. I'm not making it sound fun. It is fun. Race for the Galaxy is a very enjoyable game. It's a game I played before and quite enjoy playing. I'm a sucker for tableau builders to begin with. But I just very much have always liked the way Race for the Galaxy flows. You can definitely, there are moments where you can feel handcuffed, but for example, in my case, that was all self-imposed because I was hanging on to cards I really wanted to play. And I could have at any point pivoted and just said, you know what, I'm going to use these cards to pay for something else. I'm going to go in a different direction. And I chose to stay the course. And as a result, but that's myself. That's me feeling constrained by choices I've made myself. So in many ways, Race for Galaxy is an analogy for life, I guess.
Let's not go too far. I mean, I will say it is my favorite tableau builder, and the fact that it predated the tableau builder craze by a few years meant that I was pretty jaded for a lot of the also-rans. I do like the action selection mechanism, but what really appeals to me in Race for the Galaxy is precisely that tension that you're talking about. The fact that you pay for cards with cards mean that you've got a mittful of four or five cards, and you say, well, I can play maybe two of these, but to do that, I'm going to need to give up these other cards, so I really have to commit and make a decision. And it's those kinds of tense trade-offs that can feel liberating rather than constraining in a very real way. You have to choose your priorities. It's very much like life, actually, as a wise man once said. Make your commitments and choose your priorities. So a weird thing was made apparent to me. I've not been exposing as many gamers to Race for the Galaxy as I really should, because the period of a couple of years after it was released was a period of my explaining how to play Race for the Galaxy practically every week.
Right.
And at the time, the rules explanation for Race for the Galaxy was somewhat convoluted. And the iconographic language of Race for the Galaxy at the time was very convoluted when compared to the rest of the market. About 15 years later, Race for the Galaxy is just middleweight. And so
it's true, yeah.
I was like, maybe how's this going to work? Because the crew in question has a variety of different hobby backgrounds, and some rule sets they take to very easily and some they don't. I'm like, is this going to be overwhelming? No, it was fine. Everyone's like, yeah, sure, no problem. Because I have such vivid memories of having to explain to people, this is a windfall world. This is not a windfall world. This is a non-good world. This is a military world. This is a military windfall world. This is a non-military windfall.
This is a rebel imperial non-windfall. Yeah.
And people just being like, what? This makes no sense. I whip it out to this crew and they're like, yeah, sure, fine. Because, again, compared to even things like Revive or Civolution, Race for the Galaxy is intro weight.
Yeah.
And it's just an indication of how the market has shifted. I didn't even have any player aids or references.
Oh, they didn't need any.
Yeah, because this is in part because I got rid of the bigger box and now it's all in an expansion box.
Right.
The base game does come with player aids that are slightly larger, but they don't fit in the smaller box. I'm like, is this going to work? It worked fine. It's just, look, your modern hobbyist has developed antibodies against iconographic rule sets that I just completely underestimated. And so I'm going to have to be a little bit more aggressive in suggesting Race for the Galaxy, because it's no longer the heavy lift that it once was.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, it's very true. Especially, speaking of iconographic languages, I mean, at this point, this crew has learned to play Voidfall. So, when it comes to iconography, I think we're mostly off to the races.
Yeah, absolutely. Races. That there's some wordplay.
I keeps it topical.
Yeah. So as per usual, we played my preferred iteration of Race for the Galaxy. That is with Brink of War and the previous two expansions. No takeovers, because takeovers are where fun goes to die.
Yeah. But having read just a very small amount of those cards in the rule set.
I see what they were trying, but not for me. And we play with Goals, which are controversial, and Prestige, which is also very controversial. But again, with this, in a modern game, hobbyist games context, not too complicated. And I actually prefer Goals. I think Goals are good for new players. It gives them something to focus on. The hardcore Race for the Galaxy stands tend to look down their nose at the Goals because it introduces a certain level of arbitrariness. Because, you know, you might start with a home world that gives you a head start towards a couple of them, whereas someone else might not. I accept that. I'm willing to live with that problem, even though I acknowledge it. So that's Race for the Galaxy by Thomas Lehman, published in 2007. Still, for my money, the best of the tableau builders. We return to one of our favorites, Don't Llama Dice. And I gotta say, for a game that's not very complicated, and I dare say not very deep, I still see new game states that I find very interesting. So some of it is just you roll dice and strange things happen. Louis, in the first round, in Don't Llama Dice, if you roll three llamas, you don't return any cards. Cards are bad. They give you points. But you get to return some of your bad points, potentially 10. If you roll trip llamas in the first round when you have no points and desperately want to get rid of cards, it is, in point of fact, the worst roll you can make.
It's just straight up bad.
It's just straight up bad. He rolled trip llama twice in the first round. It was wild.
He sure did. It was something else, that's for sure.
And then, later on, I found myself in a situation where looking at what everyone had in front of them and looking at what I had in front of me, I wanted to bust.
Yes, because that's right.
I would only get two more points in busting, but when you bust, the round ends, and everyone else had much worse holdings than I did.
Yep.
And so even though I would incur additional points by busting, it was marginal, and so I wanted to bust. That was interesting, and I'd never encountered that before in Don't Llama Dice.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a situation before where someone went, wait, it's actually tactically advantageous for me to bust. And then went right ahead and busted.
Yeah, I might have decided to roll anyway, but I definitely, once I realized that the worst case scenario was even advantageous to me, roll away with abandon. And look, it's not a particularly strategic game. I did not get myself in that situation through clever choices. Like, contrast that with another Kinsey design like Beowulf the Legend. One of the great things about Beowulf the Legend is if you can afford to gamble, that's because you made good choices.
Absolutely.
In Don't Llama Dice, I was in a position to bust just because of arbitrary exogenous factors. It was not a huge deal. But it is probably the gang's favorite filler, and we keep going back to it. And the fact that, again, new stuff is showing up is enjoyable and perhaps unexpected. And so I just wanted to flag that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Don't Llama Dice is a favorite for all of us here. I took it to the cottage during the summer, and even some people looking down their noses at party games were convinced to sit down for it, and by the end of the game had committed to buying a copy for themselves. So,
yeah, this other group that you sometimes hang out with that have very strong prejudices against baby games, sometimes it rubs off on you, and
What? No, that's never happened. I've never looked at a game mark and said, wait, is this a game for babies? Are we playing a baby game?
We love games for babies. So that's Don't Llama Dice by Reiner Knizia, published by Amigo in 2021.
Walker and I got to get Windmill Valley back to the table. I don't know if you've had a chance to sit down and play Windmill Valley yet.
No, but I did play it standing on my head. I've never played Windmill Valley.
Windmill Valley is again, I'm terrible with categorizations.
Is it a game?
It is a game.
Does it come in a box?
It does. It comes in a box, and it has action selection via these gears, these two interlocking gears that you spin a certain number of notches that will then tell you what action you are doing. You can purchase upgrades that you put into the gears to change, upgrade, or even just completely overwrite existing actions. You are planting tulips in rows and columns to get points at the end of the game. You are placing out windmills in the polders to get things. It is just a generally fun game. I really enjoy Windmill Valley. It's not super deep. It's probably firmly middleweight. Some of the ideas don't quite hit. For example, there's this water level thing where you raise the water level to spin your gear more notches to do different actions. But every time you do so, you get closer and closer to the end of the game, which of course is not always advantageous. So in a lot of the games that we played, people would mostly just stay at the very bottom, turn the gear one space.
Ah.
And so that, again, perhaps that's based on us, but that potentially interesting interesting mechanic never really played out. There's a neat mechanic where you hire farmhands, and they can either come to the top of your board as a permanent upgrade. So, for example, when every time you plant tulips, you also get some points. Or every time you use a tool, you also get to build a windmill. Or you can put them at the bottom of your board to score endgame victory points. You know, if you have 12 indigo tulips, then you get a bunch of points at the end of the game. So there's some interesting push and pull about where you want things to go. I definitely found, so two players is fine, but I definitely found at three or four, when action spaces are more limited, there's less spaces to build your windmills, and there's more competition for the aforementioned farmhands, that's where it really shined. But yeah, Windmill Valley, really like it. Love to get it back to the table. Should definitely try to get to the table when you're around.
Yeah, I might be inclined to give it a try for two reasons. You had me at Gears. I do like Gears. Mm-hmm. Gears mm-hmm. are fun. And looking around the table and saying this game needs to end sooner than everyone else thinks it needs to end is a strategic exploit that I often enjoy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to say that I'm necessarily going to be in a position to fiddle around with the water level, but those kinds of considerations are often the kinds of things that I enjoy playing around with. So who knows? Got to try the Isle of Cats Duel. This is part of the increasing trend lately to take lightweight Euro games, your Splendors, your Seven Wonderses, your Isle of Cats, and turn them into two-player-only versions. This is a review copy we got from the designer, Frank West, at the City of Games, and this is, as you might expect from this trend, the two-player-only version of the Isle of Cats. First off, a mild complaint, but it actually is of substantial... I think it substantially negatively impacts my enjoyment of the game. They're all fantasy cats.
Oh, so it's not a real cats?
They're not real cats. They're not even like real cartoon cats. They're like fantasy cats and like weird like bifurcated tails and strange markings and all kinds of things. Cats are cute. You don't need to you don't need to riff on a proven design, I don't think. I seriously think that they could have improved the visual appeal for me and possibly for a lot of the market. And I'm not even a huge cat person, by just having these are the calico cats and these are the black cats and these are the white. I think that would have been great.
Absolutely.
Instead, we've got the same sort of mystical cat species that we encountered in Race to the Raft. Race to the Raft is the co-op logic puzzle card laying version that we played in the same universe, and indeed the theming and the universe is exactly the same as Isle of Cats. A salient difference between Isle of Cats and Isle of Cats Duel is that Isle of Cats had a weird sort of currency system and card drafting element. You play some cards to queue up and take some things. Now what you have is not entirely unlike Patchwork or other duel games of that nature. In the Isle of Cats Duel, you just move the marker, the magical cat, a couple of spaces or more, and then choose one of the things that it passes over. So either a cat to add to your board or a card that might let you score things. It is a very pleasant polyomino tiling experience. You're mostly just trying to cover up rats on your ship. You're trying to fill up rooms, and you're trying to create clusters of like-colored cats. They're called families. It's a game about family. Maybe they should have themed it around the Fast and the Furious franchise.
Felines and the Furious?
Nailed it. So, the Isle of Cats Duel is quick and cheerful, and if you like the Isle of Cats, I think it is definitely worth a look. It is slightly more streamlined, much more to the point than its progenitor. This is largely something that you would expect from a duelification of it. I don't know if I would recommend it over a lot of the other straightforward polyomino experiences. It's roughly on a par, I think, with something like Baron Park or a lot of the other Uwe Rosenberg pure polyomino experiences. So I'm, you know, it's definitely not in the same league or trying to be in the same league as something like A Feast for Odin or anything of that ilk. But I did get to engage in some, this, you know, the standard polyomino pleasantries of taking a cute little tile and trying to figure out if it'll fit really nicely. And at the same time, layering on top of that other scoring conditions. And it definitely doesn't crack my head wide open like Calico does. Calico is, you know, a logic puzzle masquerading as a game about cats, whereas at least in the Isle of Cats Duel, the cats may be fantastical, but you're actually just laying out cats for the most part. I enjoyed the Isle of Cats Duel. I would go back to it again. It is not particularly deep, but I did like that the scoring conditions weren't particularly baroque. It wasn't a whole lot of intersection math like you might encounter again in Calico, just to pick on that. And it did seem more satisfying than a lot of the other nature-themed tile layers of late, so like your Cascadias and games of that ilk. So the Isle of Cats Duel is light and effervescent and pretty charming, but again, I kind of wish it had real cats.
Yeah, no, that seems like a bit of an oversight. I would prefer Real Cats myself, I think.
That's The Isle of Cats Duel by Frank West and the City of Games.
Speaking of quick, but not necessarily cheerful, we got to stream White Castle Matcha. White Castle is a quick small box game where you are placing courtiers in the court and moving them up to the top of the castle, ideally. You're also placing warriors in the courtyard that will score based on your courtiers. You're taking dice from bridges to perform actions. It is a very interesting, very tight three-turn game during which you are desperately racing for your points. You can build a line of cards, so every time you perform a lantern action, you get various resources. Matcha added three more turns, effectively. Everybody gets three more turns in the game. Maybe I might be remembering exactly how many turns you get incorrectly, but it added a new type of die, so everybody gets slightly more actions. It added a new type of worker who either goes to the koi pond to admire the koi or goes and hangs out in the tea house. I feel like it didn't disrupt the existing flow of White Castle. It didn't make it longer or more onerous. It added some new interesting things you can do. Similar to what we were talking about with Revive, it opened up more pathways as opposed to overwhelming you. And so, well, originally my thought was, well, okay, that was neat, but I don't really think it added much. The more I thought about it, the more I actually think, no, this was a really good addition. It makes the game a touch longer, only a very little bit longer, but it opens up your options. I felt quite significantly and really enjoyed White Castle Matcha.
That sounds like a good trade to make. I haven't played the expansion yet. White Castle struck me as the kind of game that could possibly benefit from slightly more things to do. Like, I appreciated its efficiency. Mm-hmm. White Castle is a marvel of brevity for what it packs in there, but you know, going from say 45 minute playtime to say 55-60 minute playtime,
yeah, exactly.
But having a little bit more room to breathe, you know, it's oftentimes when it comes to Euros, it's about that sweet spot, right? Somewhere between Civolution on one end, not that it's the most complicated thing we've played, but in terms of Much Ado About Nothing, and sometimes games can be a little too hyper efficient, but
yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because on the one hand, I kind of want to gush about it just because it was good. I think it added a lot, but there's not much else to say. If you enjoy White Castle, I strongly recommend picking up the Matcha expansion. Everybody at the table seemed to have a really good time with it, and that was White Castle Matcha. It was really good.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get back to White Castle. Finally, for me, got to play Battalion War of the Ancients. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is by Paolo Mori and Francesco Cerucci. This is the same design team that did Pocket Battles. And Paolo Mori has done a number of designs that we very much like Dogs of War, like Ethnos. Definitely some of our favorites here at So Very Wrong About Games. And this is the second time I've played Battalion War of the Ancients. It is a very, very straightforward and focused game of command and control. This is not so much about a slugfest. This is about managing your command resources and not overcommitting. And every time you take damage, every time it's your turn to activate something, you have to manipulate your finite pool of command tokens, which is really a problem because taking your command tokens back is more or less how you lose. That is effectively the loss condition. How many times have you been forced to regroup? And I really appreciate that. It's counterintuitive when compared to a lot of other similarly weighted war-ish themed games. It's not a war game by any stretch of the imagination. Doesn't seek to have any level of verisimilitude, but it does seek to model this challenge of command and control. So in that sense, it actually feels a lot more simulationist than you might expect. Again, I'm not asserting that this is the kind of thing that's going to appeal to consumers by any stretch of the imagination. But it's much more satisfying in terms of command and control than a lot of other even heavier war games where it's just, activate all your units one at a time. It's like, okay, fine, whatever. And the trade-offs that introduces and the questions of tempo and when to press the advantage and when to pull back, I find really, really interesting. In point of fact, the game was decided, I think, by an inopportune charge. There was a vulnerable unit, and the thought was, it's like, oh, let's go kill it. It's like, oh, crap. What terrible, terrible thing have I done? Now I've got this cavalry unit with an order on it. I need that order elsewhere. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
And this time, we're playing the Romans versus the Carthaginians, so a slightly more historically traditional matchup as opposed to the Han Chinese versus the Greek tribes. What did you think, Jimbo?
I really enjoyed it. This was my first time playing. I am hit or miss with two-player conflict-based games because of sort of a natural aversion to conflict. I tend to prefer co-op games. I thought it was really smooth. It played really well. Yes, if you roll consistently horrifically badly, you could just get totally rolled over by bad dice. But the numbers, in my opinion, on the various units are not only reasonable, something we'll touch on later, but they make sense. For example, an archer unit needing sevens or eights on a D8 when stuck in melee combat makes sense to me. You know, they're meant to be shooting things, not in combat cudgeling each other. I particularly enjoyed the fact that the game is not about necessarily eliminating units or tabling your opponent. It touches on one of those things that I feel a lot of combat-based games don't tend to touch on, and that, you know, not a whole lot of armies historically fought to total annihilation.
Yeah.
There was a lot of retreating and giving ground and, you know, a lot of different ways in which someone looked at the battlefield and went, well, this isn't working out. I'm definitely not sticking around here to die. And I find that's quite rare in these sort of combat games, and I really appreciated it. I also liked the little touches of flavor, the abilities. Some units have abilities, some units don't. Things like envelop or impetus or disciplined that will give you minor bonuses when they're doing their specific role seemed appropriate, and they seemed to make sense. There was only one ability kind of made me raise my eyebrows a bit.
I share your misgivings. Yeah,
it's the first time I've played, so I'm trying very hard not to be the guy that makes hard and fast decisions on the first time I play anymore.
Sure, but by and large, it seems like a good set, and most of the time, it matters far more who you decide to activate than the consequences of that activation. And so, broadly speaking, I think that it's largely a success. We will talk about the dice later, I think, absolutely.
Yeah, and because you spend... when a unit is taking hits, you may either choose to have the unit be killed and absorb those hits, or you can give it command tokens as disorder in order to represent that they, you know, they've been charged and they're in disarray. And so there's this very interesting push and pull where you, okay, I would really like to keep this unit alive, but I need commands to do other things this round, so I'm not forced to rally and draw from my rapidly depleting deck. So you have to, it's very consequential decisions, borderline painful, where you're like,
yeah,
I really don't want this unit to die, but I really need these commands, so I think I might just have to let them go. I found that to be a very interesting and very compelling decision-making space.
And it definitely tempted me into making irrational feast or famine decisions, right? Immediately after a regroup, I've got all the tokens I could ever need. And 2 turns later, like, oh no.
I definitely did that. My first two regroups were really bad because I was like, oh, well, this cavalry unit can just charge. And then I'm going to spend order units as disorder to make sure they don't suffer any wounds on that. And I've spent 4 of my 6 command on my first act. Oh no.
I suspect the larger scenarios where you can play with 8 units and 8 command tokens will mitigate that somewhat. I mean, you're never going to be in a position where you have all the orders you need.
Absolutely.
But I'm looking forward to trying it with an 8-unit game because there might be a little bit less of a feast or famine situation and give you a little bit more rope to engage in risks that won't necessarily be catastrophic. But anyway, yeah, I've been very, very pleased with Battalion War of the Ancients. I hope this is a game system that Osprey supports because Pocket Battles had many factions released, and they could definitely do the same with War of the Ancients without too much difficulty.
Absolutely.
And it's got lovely Roland McDonald art, and I've been having a great time with Battalion War of the Ancients.
I got to get Spirit Island back to the table. I got to play with Louis and the Trefor, sometimes referred to as the creature from the sea.
They're both actually Louis.
Oh, they're both Louis.
They're both Louis.
Ah, well, then there you go. I got to play with Louis and Louis. We have talked in the past about how Spirit Island does an excellent job of obfuscating when you are already winning by making you think that you're actually losing. This continued that trend, but the veil was pierced briefly. For those who are familiar with Spirit Island, I tend to fill. I like to let other people at the table choose the spirits they want to play, and then I like to play spirits that support them. Occasionally, I will just pick something outright, usually Heart of the Wildfire, so I can whoosh boom the whole map. But Louis chose Sunbright Whirlwind, who I frequently call Suncat, who is a push-gather spirit. Louis, the other Louis, has been playing it on Steam, and so chose to go with the basic spirit that he had been playing on the Steam game in River Surges and Sunlight, also a push-gather spirit. I said to myself, well, if I'm playing with two push-gather spirits, I'm going to play Ocean's Hungry Grasp. This allows them to have a bit more offense to their push-gather, and they can fuel my engine. And it was merciless. We stomped, smashed, and flattened our opponents. At no point was it even really in question. There was a small period where the interior of my board, not uncommon for Ocean's Hungry Grasp, was looking kind of dicey, and then Sunbright Whirlwind swept over and completely devastated absolutely everything. it was quite shocking, but it was very fun. Spirit Island's always fun, even when it's a raffle stomp.
It definitely makes murder more fun than any other game I can think of. Just the absolute massacres that you
It's
can...
so true. The terrible things that you make befall
the
these
nightmarish
poor...
nightmarish tortures, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Death falls gently from open blossoms. Or just surprise tigers.
Ah, the unexpected tigers. Spirit Island was designed by, full disclosure, personal friend of mine, R. Eric Royce. And for those patrons that thrill to Sizzler, there will be more Sizzler coming soon. So those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.
Another app for inventory, one for CRM. Oh, don't forget accounting. Wait, which login was that?
Or you could use Odoo, one fully integrated system that does it all without the hassle. Ditch the app overload. Get everything your business needs on one platform. Try Odoo free today at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. So, as mentioned, we do indeed have a Patreon. This is a multiple of 5 episodes. We will acknowledge that we have a Patreon. Lots of bonus content. We average about 1 bonus episode a week. We've got some Sizzler coming up. We've got Bloat. We've got more philosophy to come. I've been prepping another episode about ethics because people asked for it, because you got to give the people what they want.
Absolutely.
And we dance to their whims. Free games, newsletters, all the good things. You can check it out on patreon.com/swag. And, of course, ad-free episodes. Moving on. Snapships Tactics is a delightful game of toys, and when it came out, I'm like, okay, I'm all in, I'll get all that they have, but I hope what they do, that this is not just an opportunity to move old stock, just to give game rules to an existing toy line, but I hope that they introduce new units, new stuff, that they engineer new plastic pieces to build for the ships with new stats and stuff, and they're going to be doing that, Jimbo. They were PAX Unplugged. There's going to be more Snapships Tactics. This is a live product line, more cockpits, especially because there were not enough cockpits.
No, there definitely were not.
Ooh, no, not nearly enough. So expanded options, new ship types. I am thrilled that this line is continuing. Snapships Tactics.
I'm so pleased to hear that. I really enjoyed Snapships Tactics. The toy factor is through the roof. It's just a fun time. And I shared your misgivings that it was just a way to move old stock. I am really jazzed to hear that there's going to be more.
Behold Rome by Joe Klipfel is on the Game Crafter, so if you want a very challenging, in the best way, solo card game where you're upgrading cards and downgrading cards and massaging tempo and dealing with lots of challenges and then realizing that you've painted yourself into a corner because solo will not work, well, you're in trouble. So Behold Rome is up on the Game Crafter, highly recommended. Go check it out. Finally, excellent news continuing for the designs of Zoe Allred. Zoe Allred designed a game called Persuasion, which we tried not too long ago. It's a marvelous Austinian party game of collusion and snubbing and weird courtship as characterized by the universe inhabited by Jane Austen and stories of that ilk. Persuasion was signed by Hollenspiel, which I think is a marvelous publisher to bring it to market. I love Hollenspiel as a publisher. They do lots of interesting and weird things that other publishers will not do, and so it is very good for the hobby that Hollenspiel exists, and I like a lot of their designs. But on top of that, Zoe Allred has a whole bunch of other designs that it was showing off at PAX Unplugged, and Zoe Allred, I think, is a designer to watch, and I'm very much looking forward to its future content, but Persuasion is the one that I've played. Keep your eyes open for Persuasion if any of that sounds appealing. So that is the news, and why it doesn't matter, we now move on to our topic, which is what makes you so mad? Why so mad? Why are you so angry?
Why are you so mad, bro?
Why are you so mad, bro? So can we actually start by talking about Battalion War of the Ancients?
Absolutely.
Because I don't find Battalion War of the Ancients frustrating, but it is part of a design idiom that I find problematic with respect to randomness. And a lot of games in that idiom I genuinely enjoy. The foremost example of this actually is the Undaunted series. And that is a small volume of dice rolls.
Right.
You talked about how the numbers were well calibrated. I agree with you. The thresholds are reasonable. The thresholds are reasonable in Undaunted as well. At least, I'll circle back to the final thing I said about Battalion War and the Ancients. At least no particular die roll struck me as particularly consequential in the context of Battalion War and the Ancients. Sometimes in Undaunted, look, I love Undaunted, but sometimes there are these high consequence rolls and you just pull out a 10. So it's like, okay, I hit you from across the map and your turn is ruined and the tide of the battle can shift. I think if you're going to have dice, I'm always going to mitigate towards a larger volume just to smooth out those possible results.
I completely agree. So frequently, if when I complain about randomness, some people at the table, pointed stare, might say something like, I find it fascinating how Dungeons & Dragons players come to board gaming and complain about randomness.
No. I'm being quoted out of context here. What I find fascinating is the series of neuroses that tabletop role players in general, I don't want the D&D stands crawling out of the woodwork, the various kinds of superstitions that they come up, like you need to rub the die a certain way, this die is rolling well so it will continue to roll well, or this die is rolling well so it won't roll well ever again. This is my saving throw die. It saves me from death. This is my combat die. It kills things. Blah, 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 blah. That's the part that I find weird. Complaining about randomness? Whatever. But, like, it's the pathological desire to think that you have any control over
any kind of control over randomness at all, yes. Yeah. One of the things that my frequent counter, because you are not the only person to have brought this up to me, is that I actually, as a gamer, have gotten to a point where I find Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder and other D20-based systems unsatisfying because it is a single die base with a tremendous variance. 1 to 20 is a huge variance. And frequently, particularly at early stages of the game, very limited ability to modify that. You're looking at like ones and twos. And don't get me wrong, a plus two is huge. That's a bonus 10%. But it still modifies the dice in unsatisfying ways. Whereas traveling into dice pool-based games, World of Darkness, Shadowrun, that sort of thing, I tend to find I am happier. So I tend to agree where throwing more dice sort of blunts that feeling of, well, that frustrating thing just happened.
Yeah.
And there's, I feel like I had no control over it.
So to contrast Battalion War of the Ancients with something like Claustrophobia. So in Battalion War of the Ancients, this is both the good and the bad part of it in terms of how it deals with randomness. You spend these valuable resources to order the thing, and then your opponent might do a reaction or what have you, or you might throw bonus cards at the issue. You'll probably be rolling like three or four dice, and if you desperately need at least one of them to hit, and they all fail, that can be rough, especially since you've spent all those resources in the output. Contrast that with something like Claustrophobia, where activations are free, which admittedly makes the game less interesting. And it tends to have a much higher volume. You're pitching like five dice and you need to hit threes. So it's a question of whether you're going to be doing two hits or four. And, you know, at that point, it's not as big of a deal. And this, of course, deals with the fascinating distinction between input randomness and output randomness. Are you familiar with this distinction?
I don't think so.
So input randomness is the difference in short. Look, if I go into too much detail, I'm sure all the math nerds are going to crawl out of the woodwork and explain to me how I'm wrong, which is fine. I'm not that good at math. After linear algebra, I stopped paying attention.
Should I lean back and open my mouth and let my soul escape? Is that something?
No. Okay. But there's a difference between a universe where the die tells you whether or not you succeed and the dice lay out the available options you have on your turn. right? So a lot of modern Euros have dice placement systems. Like, for example, one that we like a lot more is Marco Polo.
Yes. Right?
The Voyages of Marco Polo, where it's dice placement, and it's like, okay, well, this manages the contours of what I'm able to do. And it tends to be less of a hard, you can't do that. It's just a question of how much do I have to pay? Am I going to get more of this resource or the other?
White Castle is the same way.
The dice manage the
contours of what you're going to do, as opposed to giving you a hard... Well, there are some situations, but that's frequently engineered by other players.
Sure. As opposed to something where... Like, I played a game called Burning Suns with you once, where it was a worker placement sci-fi game, and you place the worker, and then you roll a die to see if the thing works. And it's like, No. Overall, it massaged that system relatively well. It wasn't as awful, but just as a facial idea, like, why bother? Like, why are you doing this? You're not adding anything to this. And again, if it's going to be a low volume of die rolls that determine whether or not you get to take your turn, it's messed up. And circling back to Civolution, it's really frustrating when you've got a relatively small pool of dice. You typically have something like 6 to 8 dice. It takes 2 dice of specific values to do anything. And yeah, you can end up doing any action you want after you skip the necessary number of turns.
Yep.
That's not awesome.
No, that feels frustrating.
So can you recall specific instances in which, at any kind of gaming table situation, where you... You know, pitched your roll or drew a card or something, and you just wanted to blow your top? Because I've got a couple.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of it in Dungeons & Dragons Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Until very recently in the game of Pathfinder 2nd Edition I'm playing in, my big attack spells, just 10 or lower. Always rolled a 10 or lower.
You have to make attack rolls on attack spells in Pathfinder?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wild.
Well... So no, some of them hit, but they cause saving throws, which ironically, here's one of the things that I have to acknowledge about myself is that my reaction to randomness is itself unpredictable based on what kind of randomness it is. So for example, if I have to make a spell attack roll and I miss consistently, I find that frustrating. If I have a spell that hits, but the opponent makes a saving throw to mitigate the effect,
yes,
and they consistently roll well, that does not frustrate me for some reason.
It's the old trick that Games Workshop first introduced. And for all the crap that I give to Games Workshop games, and I really don't like most Games Workshop games, they're onto something like making an armor roll, even though it's tedious. And oh my goodness, the cross-referencing that it involves. And just how long the turn gets and how burdensome a simple attack is in a tabletop miniatures rule set. It gives the opponent something to do.
Absolutely.
And if they succeed on an armor save roll, I agree with you, but it's psychologically different to have them succeed at their test versus my failing at my check.
Yep. The clearest example I've ever seen is we were quite into Descent for a while. Descent uses a variety of different colored dice, and you always roll, I believe it's the blue die. And the blue die has on it, one of its 6 sides is an X,
yes,
which is you just miss. Which felt, and I'm not saying it is, it felt desperately unsatisfying to roll a huge handful of dice and see that lone blue X pull up. When they ported that dice system to Star Wars for Imperial Assault, they removed the X from the blue die. Instead, enemies rolled either black dice if they were armored, or white dice if they were light units. And the
in defense.
And the white die had a dodge symbol. Effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
But much less unsatisfying in that case, and partially because the heavy units just didn't randomly dodge. But that, again, that changing it from you just miss.
Yeah.
It's because you suck to actually your opponent dodged. He's kind of cool. Changing that narrative made it more satisfying. I vastly prefer the Imperial Assault system to the Descent system, even though realistically that's basically the only change.
Well, going back to D&D, I always remember... You know, I've played every edition of D&D but 5th, actually. You know, the trade-off that you made as a wizard most of the time in 1 through 3. 4 changed everything. I actually kind of liked 4. Whatever.
4th edition's my favorite system. Fight me.
Wow. Wow. We're dropping bombs here on Super Roundabout Games.
That's how I feel about it.
Yeah. But in 1 to 3, the idea was that wizards don't get to do much, but when they do it, it works. So, like, with some exceptions. So, like, Magic Missile never misses.
Absolutely.
It's just how much damage you do. If your opponent makes a saving throw on Fireball, it halves the damage, but they're still going to get cooked.
Yeah.
And that, I felt, was entirely appropriate, given the fact that they had a very finite pool of resources. And then, so then there were other spells where it was an all-or-nothing thing. And it's like, no. And as, whenever I was in a position to do that, if it's going to be something that you have to save up to do. I mean, make it work. Like, Gloomhaven kind of understood this to a certain extent, right? Even if you completely miss on your massive attack, if it loads on status effects, the status effects still work.
Gloomhaven really nailed for me the solid stance between purely deterministic gaming and just the right amount of, because especially once you start being able to modify your own attack deck, I really, really enjoyed how they did that.
It's like a very, very, very customizable die.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally understand why customizable dice aren't a regular thing. It's a huge pain in the butt. They really nailed that, that sort of thing. But you're right. It's the part of it is the big thing, right? To go back to the Pathfinder Dungeons and Dragons example, if I miss with a low-level spell, it's still a resource. I've still saved up a resource and used it, but it doesn't feel as bad as pulling out your big, you know, holy ray, being like, ha-ha! Sad face.
Yeah, absolutely. It's weird. The most frustrating thing that I find, and this is not because I'm some great soul or anything, is that when my opponent just cannot catch a break.
I know.
Honestly, I think one of the worst things, going back to the game we just recently played, a Battalion War of the Ancients, it was not particularly consequential, but you had charged my archers, and I had 3 dice to roll, and I only hit on 8s, and I rolled 2 8s. It's like, okay. Now, had it been super consequential, had that been the thing to decide the game, like a nonsense, incredibly outside chance from a weak unit, I would have felt terrible.
Yep, absolutely.
I wouldn't want to win under those conditions. Like, I in the same way that I don't want to win because I roll all 1s, I hate winning on all 8s even more.
Absolutely.
On an 8-sided die.
One of the things that pushed me out of wargaming, and this may be my own you know, collection of neuroses, is if the dice are just consistently smacking my opponent, and my opponent's getting frustrated and they're not having fun, I'm picking up on them not having fun, and now I'm not having fun, and now neither of us are having fun, and why are we playing this game?
Honestly, that was one of the downsides of Infinity, because the way Infinity handles math on tabletop miniatures war game is brilliant. There's the possibility of outside shots working, strange things happen, but by and large, if you can master the numbers, you will exert a reliable but not insurmountable advantage in terms of applying usually firepower. The problem is that the math is incredibly opaque, and as a consequence of that, the fact that it works so well is also opaque. And I found, in terms of the discrepancy between people's perceptions of how the numbers worked and how the numbers actually worked, a greater distance in Infinity than almost any other game I've ever played.
Fascinating.
And it's not because they were dumb.
Yeah.
It was just because the way the numbers shook out, I had to spend a lot of time with, like, very complicated tools, because it's not parsable. Look, if you give me 3d6 and tell me that I need to hit certain numbers, I can do a rough back of the envelope estimate in terms of probability. I know enough about probability to do that. Infinity rolls, where I'm rolling 3d20 and the opponent's rolling 2d20, and higher rolls cancel out lower rolls, and then I just can't do it. I have no conception. So that I spent hours, just because I found it interesting, on websites that would calculate the odds for you and tell you the probability of various results happening. And that made me realize how great the curves were for almost every action in Infinity, almost. And I would play games with people, and the, you know, expected result would happen. And they're like, oh, that's nonsense. That was unlikely. It's no, actually, this was the expected result. This precise thing happens 56% of the time. The thing that you're saying should have happened only happens like 20% of the time. And they didn't believe me. And I respect that, because I only knew it because I'd seen it.
Yeah, because you'd put the extra research into it.
Yeah. And so consequently, it was, you know, dealing with, I would get frustrated on occasion when the expected result didn't happen, of course.
Mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But more often, in the case of Infinity, the frustration came from my opponents, who expected something to work when they shouldn't have.
Right.
And again, not because they were good, it's because the math behind Infinity was so cool. It was just too intricate to be immediately transparent.
Yeah, sufficiently opaque that it wasn't... It was not simple to grok what your percentage chances of success.
Absolutely, were. Absolutely, and it also did the other thing that I've been talking about. It had the advantage of large volumes of dice most of the time. Like, and there's something satisfying and dramatic about a fistful of D20s, right?
Yeah, 100%.
or some of those war games where you get together like 35 D6 and just dump them all out on the table.
Yeah,
because It's also good that that generates drama, because the more deterministic your dice system is, the less drama you're going to have in the results. So you might as well have a little bit of spectacle thrown in there.
Yeah, it's a strange dichotomy where, you know, the more you take, where you, the more deterministic and thus perhaps the more satisfying for some people it is, the less drama there is, the less heart-stopping moments, the less cheering moments. The by taking out some of that randomness, you risk losing a certain degree of flair.
Yeah.
That said, I get exceptionally frustrated when games, usually board games, but there are other types of games, settle on double randomness as their chosen option.
Sure.
I get particularly frustrated when there's, for example, dice and random card draw.
Yeah.
Or we recently played a game, I apologize, I don't remember the name, that's a bag builder with
Trudvagi Legends.
There we go. With different runes, and you randomly draw your abilities from your deck, and then apply these randomly drawn runes. And that drove me wild.
Well, I was actually going to say something different about Trudvang Legends. In Trudvang Legends' defense, you, at any given turn, have half of your deck available.
Yes.
Right? So there's that. Yes, you're right. It is a random sub-selection of cards, but it is half of your deck. And that does lead to occasionally frustrating dynamics of, well, this is not a turn I can attack this round. And that's not great. I freely admit. The thing that, you know, uniting back our discussion about Gloomhaven and Trudvang Legends, it has, you know, a similar kind of mechanism for doing monster AI for determining how much damage they do, but the variance is so much higher and the deck is so much skinnier than it is in Gloomhaven.
Yeah.
And we kept pulling that +3 and oh my goodness, that was frustrating for everybody.
Yeah. That was, and
nobody wanted to touch that deck by the end of the
game. Yeah, and you can, you know, logically, you know, this is just, it's just bad luck. This is an outside chance that keeps happening.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's the same, I don't know, say that deck is 10 cards. It's the same 1 in 10 chance. We have just as much chance of drawing any other number.
Yeah.
But after the third or fourth time it happens, you're just kind of like, okay, I'm starting to maybe think that maybe we should just walk away. Maybe we should. We had a very similar experience playing Kingdom Death Monster, where we drew the murder event.
Yeah.
I want to say 6 camp events in a row.
It was wild.
Just murder, murder, murder. It got to the point, now, we're not hardcore, whatever, as soon as the dice, you know, as soon as everything hits the table, it must be. But by and large, we will stay with things as they go. It got to the point that we would just be like, okay, so we flip the first event, it's murder, we ignore it,
yeah,
and we flip an actual event.
Yeah, it just became routine. We don't engage in judicious cheating much with co-op games. But, you know, if you're going to cheat, if you're going to engage in cheating, you know, Kingdom Death Monster is a pretty good candidate at that point.
Yeah, Kingdom Death Monster is another example, in my opinion, of a game that both has satisfying randomness in the monster battles and incredibly unsatisfying randomness in the hunt events.
Yeah.
Early on, your rolls against most of the monsters are going to suck. Your gear is not up to par. Your stats are not up to par. Good dice will still help you, but you're in a bad spot. But the game makes it very clear that that is the spot you are in. It makes it, there's no bones that you are on the back foot and you're going to be on the back foot.
No, there are a lot of bones. There are a lot of bones.
No, that's true. He's right. There are a lot of bones.
A lot of bones.
That you are going to be on the back foot for a while. And that makes it, when you do finally start building those pieces of equipment and doing neat combinations, it feels very good. It's still a little frustrating because it involves a random hit deck. The Kingsman is the worst example of this, combined with random dice rolls, but it doesn't even hold a candle to how desperately unsatisfying the hunt table is.
Yeah.
So for those who have not played, when you are hunting your prey, some of the spaces are prey-specific hunts, which I generally find very interesting. They usually have neat push-pull mechanics where you're like, are you going to take a risk to maybe get to your prey sooner and risk it being prepared for you? Or are you going to fall back and risk it, you know, pulling longer and you maybe risk starvation, but you're going to be better prepared for it. And then there are blank spaces where you roll on the hunt table. Now, in defense of the designer, the second edition of the game, it's not called the second edition, but the second printing of the hunt table is much better. However, it still commits, in my opinion, the cardinal rule, which is roll 2 random dice or die.
Yeah.
In no game anywhere has that ever been a satisfying result.
Oh, so you don't like the first edition of D&D the most then?
Oh my goodness. So one of the things that I'm going to get a bit soapboxy. One of the things that Pathfinder 2nd edition does amazingly that Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition does incredibly badly is that they have really mitigated save or suck.
Mm.
Which is where, you know, I remember from 2nd ed D&D, it's called a death save.
Yeah.
Roll a save versus death or die.
Yeah.
Again, in no world Is that a satisfying outcome?
Yes, I hear you all. All of you keyboard warriors, put them away.
In no way is that a satisfying
outcome. Remember, this is Jimbo here. I'm not saying any of this. This is all Jimbo.
What they've done now for Pathfinder is, so here's the effect of the spell. If they fail, this effect is halved.
Right.
If they critically succeed, which is an outside chance, maybe they ignore it completely. But if they critically fail, it's even worse for them.
I see.
And that alone has... Now, Pathfinder still commits the cardinal sin of having, I believe what they call... Nope, I've forgotten the name. Unmodified dice rolls to get rid of ongoing effects. So you are suffering 8 bleed damage every round. You must roll a 9 or better, unmodified on a d20. I could rant for hours about it. But roll an unmodified die, and then just, if you fail, you die. That's awful. I'm generally a fan of Kingdom Death Monster. It has mechanics that I don't enjoy, and it has some, there are other things about it that I find questionable or frustrating. Overall, I have enjoyed my time with it. I very much like the camp building. I like the unlocking things like language and art. I like the individual hunt phases. I like battling the monsters. The hunt table makes me so angry every time we roll on it. And now maybe that's what the designer was going for. Maybe he wanted that to evoke that deeply unfair in a dark system where all the odds are against you. I can do that by going outside.
But frustration and dread are two very different sentiments, right?
Yes.
This is one of the reasons why a lot of board games that I found unsatisfying, a lot of their defenses, like for example, this War of Mine, mm-hmm. I found very unsatisfying as a game in the board game version. It's like, no, but you see, that's the horrors of war. No, it's not the horrors of war. It's the tedium of accounting. Exactly. There's a difference. And I think this is a good place to close it out. The thing that Kingdom Death Monster does, I don't have the same problem that you do when there are dice that interact with cards, right? So, for example, Battle Lore or any of the Commands and Colors series, that doesn't bother me because the cards determine the contour of what you're able to do, and then so it has both the input and output styles of randomness. The cards determine the contours of what you're able to do, and then, yeah, sometimes the dice rolls break a bad way, but on average, most of the systems, you're going to have enough volume of dice that you're going to get the expected results, broadly speaking, and so the better player tends to, well... The scenario balance is also suspect. Setting all that aside, the compounding factor that I find deeply frustrating, and Kingdom Death Monster is a great example, is that you get to deal with the arbitrary random hunt events that get you to the arbitrary random battle, that get you to the arbitrary random settlement events, right? And so in order to get anywhere... Like, if you tell me that this is a game about hunting very dangerous monsters, fine. Let me get to the monster and have the monster bite my head off. If the monster bites my head off, that's cool. Don't make me do a whole bunch of dice checks to get to the monster and then do more dice checks on top of that. I don't care how it's randomized. One could be cards, one could be tiles. The other could be dice rolls. They could be flipping coins for all I care. Make it a dreidel. I don't care. The point is that it's compounding in a weird kind of sense. It's like, what if you had to do more dangerous things before? Look, you have identified the cool, dangerous thing.
Yep.
Fighting a monster is a cool, dangerous thing.
Very much so.
Telling me, it's flavorful, but it's not satisfying for me. It's like, oh, you took a wrong turn, you get swallowed up by the darkness and die. I know the universe is dangerous.
Yeah.
It is satisfying to me in a board game to have the danger be a lion biting my head off. It is Absolutely. Not satisfying to me in a board game, maybe in a video game, maybe, to die of tetanus on the way. Yeah. Or like, dysentery is
you
deadly.
You have died of dysentery.
Exactly. So setting all that aside... So having skewered a variety of D&D systems as well as the beloved Oregon Trail.
Indeed.
That's going to do it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you, Jimbo, very much for stepping in.
Thank you for having me.
For Michael Walker, we will be returning to our regular form of nonsense, assuming that Walker is once again at a functional level. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for spending some time with us. We hope that you take care of your hobby, take care of yourselves. Self-care is a moral obligation. And as always, thank you, Rules Explainer. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
The Jeep brand has always stood for American freedom. Now with our Freedom of Choice pricing program, you can choose your offer. Cash incentives or employee pricing for all. Hurry into your local dealer today for details. Jeep. There's only one. Offer valid on select 2024 and 2025 Jeep brand vehicles for non-FCA employees and retirees. $200 admin fee applies. Not all buyers and lessees will qualify. Restrictions apply. Not combinable with other offers. Ends 4/30/2025. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Spreadsheets, clunky software, 100 different logins just to run your business? Ah.
There's a better way. Odoo. One simple, connected platform that handles sales, inventory, accounting, and more. So you can focus on growing, not juggling. Make the switch today at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com.